low-flying planes.
To be jailed by an occupying force in your own country, it must be hard enough to bear. But imagine cowering in a cell as bombs rain down on you. Bombs dropped by your own allies.
The bombing at Amiens jail in northern France in February 1944 was one of the most daring and controversial air raids of the war.
We had the honor of going in first, and if we hadn't completed the job, they were to go in and literally blow the prison apart.
It's hard to imagine the chaos and carnage inside the jail. Amidst the dead and the dying, the lucky few picked their way out amongst the rubble.
But why did the RAF attack a jail holding resistance fighters? Many were killed. Was there someone inside whose freedom was so important? And what secrets did they hold? And why did they risk the life of Britain's most famous bomber pilot, a hero and a film star, on a mission he described as death or glory? As an aviator with a passion for war stories that's been with me since boyhood, I'm fascinated by this particular story. And 67 years after the raid, the motives for it are still shrouded in mystery.
So I'm flying back on the same route the bombers took to see if I can shed some light on the raid they called Operation Jericho.
Martin Shaw is in an aeroplane flying at low level above a vast expanse of water. A file marked Top Secret opens up, revealing the words Operation Jericho. Martin is driving a car.
I'm on my way to meet living aviation history. Last surviving member of the Mosquito crews from the Jericho raid.
This is a recording that pilot officer Maxwell Sparks made after the raid in 1944 for the BBC.
The loudspeaker broke rudely into my sleep early on that February morning. It barked through our hut with a list of air crews who were wanted at the briefing room at once. My own name was on the list. Of all things, it was snowing. If we were being yanked out of bed to fly in that stuff, it must be either some kind of practice or some kind of a practical joke. But when we found guards posted at the briefing room and they asked us to prove our identity, we knew there was neither a joke nor a practice in the air.
Maxwell Sparks was part of the Royal New Zealand Air Force contingent who joined Australian and British air crews on Operation Jericho. Even these hand-picked airmen could not possibly have been prepared for what they were asked to carry out.
The jail at Amiens in France, and more than 100 Frenchmen were held there, awaiting death.
The idea of the raid was to break the walls of the prison open and bomb the German guards' quarters while they were at lunch, to enable the French resistance people to get out.
Were you aware that there could have been casualties amongst the resistance fighters?
Yes, we're very much alive to the fact that we could kill a few people that we hadn't intended to. All I could say is that war is cruel, and I mean, it's difficult to say, but it had to be done. Men and women that had helped escaping air crews, prisoners of war escaping, people who'd done a hell of a lot for us, and we'd found out that they preferred to die by British bombs rather than German bullets.
A shutter in a cell door is opened.
Some believe there were no resistance fighters awaiting execution that day.
Luchot, Picardie.
In France, what's considered in Britain as one of the RAF's finest achievements is often seen in a very different light. Retired doctor Jean-Pierre Ducellier was living here with his grandparents 20 miles away from Amiens when the raid took place. Operation Jericho became his lifelong obsession. For decades, he has studied the raid and has published a book which he claims disproves the official version of events.
L'histoire de Jericho.
The story of Jericho has always interested me. I had an aunt and uncle who lived close to the prison, and they fled to their cellar where the bombs were going off, so I knew a bit about the story. But it was the need to find out what really happened that set me off on this course. One day, a veteran RAF officer came to the area to give a talk, and it was nothing but a tissue of lies. I found a lawyer who looked after the prisoners who were due to appear in front of the military tribunal at this time. And he assured me that absolutely no one was condemned to death in Amiens prison in February 1944. Never mind 120 people, there wasn't even one. There were no resistance workers to save, so why was the order given to attack the prison?
Martin makes his way through a storage room at the National Archives, London. Shelves are lined with coloured boxes marked with letters and numbers.
I'm here to look at the official files on the raid. Maybe they'll offer some clues. The records show that 7 months after Operation Jericho, which still had not been made public, the RAF dispatched one of its own intelligence officers, Squadron Leader Edwin Houghton, to the now liberated city of Amiens on a fact-finding mission.
Part of Houghton's mission was to find out exactly who had requested the attack and how many were to be executed. He found answers to neither question.
So the RAF couldn't establish why it had been asked to carry out the raid. It's officially claimed that leaders of the French resistance had requested it through intelligence channels.
There were two main secret services working into France during the Second World War. The first was the Secret Intelligence Service, also known as MI6, and the other was the Special Operations Executive, or SOE. SIS was the mature veteran of the setup. SOE was the new kid on the block, only been formed in 1940.
Both secret services ran covert sorties into occupied France in order to support the French resistance fighters, dropping agents and equipment behind enemy lines.
They did different things. SIS wanted to go. They used quiet stealth to secure intelligence. SOE wanted to create armed resistance. This, of course, occasioned some substantial amount of rivalry between the two, and this was compounded by the fact that they were rivals for the same aircraft, the Royal Air Force, the same recruits that they wanted to turn into secret agents, the same sort of resources. So, not a very happy relationship, all things considered.
Into this murky world of espionage were pitched Group Captain Charles Picard and his navigator, Flight Lieutenant Alan Broadley. Working on secret missions behind enemy lines, they formed one of the most enduring partnerships of the war, flying more than 100 operations together. And they would go on to lead Operation Jericho.
He had dropped a French agent off somewhere in France, and his aircraft got stuck in the mud. And all the French resistance fighters who were there all had to come out of the bushes and the woods and push his aircraft to get it flying again.
Pick got a pin or something, pricked his thumb and Alan's, and they put it together. Pick said, now we're blood brothers.
Picard was a battle-hardened pilot, but his face was world famous thanks to his role in one of wartime Britain's most popular movies.
Target for tonight.
Well, that's a good thing. I haven't been off the ground for a week. It's all very well for you. I had a party tonight. Well, that saved your headache. Thank you very much.
I've come to watch Target for Tonight, okay, the film that made Charles Picard a reality star of his time. Barry Norman knew the director who cast Picard.
Why do you think they chose Picard to play the lead? He's a fairly unlikely choice on the face of it.
He's not a bad-looking guy, is he? I thought he played his part very well. And he was already a war hero, after all, wasn't he? I mean, this was a guy who collected 3 Distinguished Service Orders and 1 Distinguished Flying Cross. Well, I think he got a couple of the DSOs before they made this film, or around about the time they made this film. I don't know, I would think Harry Watt, whom I knew slightly, would probably have cast a very careful eye over the available candidates and just decided he's for the best, and I think he was a good choice.
Crew of F for Fred. Dixon, your captain.
Picard stars as Squadron Leader Dixon, leading his men in a low-level bombing raid over Germany. Target for tonight was a government propaganda film showing a raid through the eyes of a fictional bomber crew in the plane F for Freddy. But all the crews in the movie were real airmen.
What impact did the film have in Britain and in the wider world in general?
Very positive. I mean, not only here, but in America, because it was shown in about 12,000 cinemas in America. I think it's a really good documentary, and it was very important at the time because it was really the first documentary we made in this country during the war that showed Britain fighting back.
I hope we haven't kept you waiting, sir.
Good Lord, now. Come and sit down.
I think Picard would have become quite a hero to the cinema audience of that time because it was a time when Britain was looking for heroes.
What colour?
The rest of the crew obviously had huge respect for him and affection too, I think.
Sure. You know.
And yeah, he had that quality. He's the kind of guy you would follow. You know, you'd go tiger shooting with Picard, wouldn't you? Not that you want to shoot a tiger, but you know what I mean.
The End. St Albans, Hertfordshire.
This is where Operation Jericho was made possible. An aircraft capable of the speed, accuracy and agility necessary to pull off a seemingly impossible raid was designed and built here. A warplane so good, it beggars belief that furniture makers built it from plywood. This is the de Havilland Mosquito, the wooden wonder.
And that's the prototype. How amazing.
Yes, we've just dismantled it this year.
And how did it start? How did the RAF come to commission a wooden aeroplane?
Well, they didn't. They
were dead. Was it their idea, or did de Havilland put it to them?
Private enterprise, de Havilland. They were turned down. They thought they were crazy.
Yeah.
Geoffrey de Havilland said, we've got to do something for the war effort with all that experience. And so the Mosquito was evolved. The prototype was built where you're standing, here, which is behind us.
Yeah.
It was dismantled, taken over to Hatfield, test flown by young Geoffrey de Havilland. And it was so great, they called the Air Ministry down, and of course, when they saw it, cancelled all the other orders. Mosquito, Mosquito.
What was it about the Mosquito that was so perfect for the Jericho raid?
I don't think there was another aircraft capable of a raid that was planned as per Picard's raid. Low level, high speed, highly manoeuvrable, and virtually impossible to catch. Its defence was speed.
Yes.
It was the fastest aircraft. From 41 to 44.
That long?
That long.
I turn green with envy when I see the Mosquito. The British knocked together a beautiful wooden aircraft that every piano factory there is making. These are the words of Hermann Göring, Commander-in-Chief of the Luftwaffe.
The aircraft that we had on the squadron previous to the Mosquito was the Lockheed Ventura. The difference was the difference between Del Boy's three-wheeler and an F1 Grand Prix car.
Hunsdon Airfield, Hertfordshire.
Today, there are few clues to suggest that one of the most remarkable raids of the war was launched from here.
A lightweight aircraft has its engine running.
The men who could unlock many of the mysteries of Operation Jericho once lived and flew from here.
A line of aircraft, then a flag fluttering in the breeze.
Today, all but a handful are gone, their secrets with them. But this is where the 18 Mosquitoes took off in February 1944. Only microlights fly from here now. And it's only from above that you can still see the outline of the old runways.
The runway is overgrown.
So we'll be taking off elsewhere to fly the route of Operation Jericho.
Sewell Aerodrome, Northamptonshire.
Today, we're attempting to retrace the Mosquito bomber's flight to Amiens.
We're going to fly down the western side of London and join their route at Henley.
And I'll be navigating for Chris Norton, a former RAF Harrier pilot who saw action in Kosovo and the Gulf War. He, like Pickard, received the Distinguished Flying Cross for his courage in the air. Pickard led the raid despite having had very few flying hours experience in a Mosquito or of daytime low-level attacks. Operation Jericho was originally to have been led by Air Vice Marshal Basil Embry, but at short notice, he was told he couldn't fly.
Basil Embry's commander-in-chief, Air Chief Marshal Sir Stafford Leigh Mallory, forbade him to go on the raid, partly because he was known to have inside knowledge of Operation Overlord and many other aspects of Allied operations. He'd also been shot down previously in the war and escaped from Germany and was a wanted man as far as the Germans were concerned.
And they were attacking from this direction, were they? Not here?
Yes.
I've flown with Chris before. We retraced the route of the famous Dambusters raid last year. And I'm a qualified pilot. But the thought of flying at ultra-low level across the channel is making me somewhat nervous.
We'll set off 120 across the channel. This bit here will fly low until we hit that straight old Roman road.
Lovely road.
And that will lead us straight to the prison.
Nearly 70 years ago, the crews could barely believe the target they were being asked to attack.
Well, it's one of the very first truly precision raids. In 1944, precision could mean several hundred yards between a bomb and its target and still be considered to be quite precise. But in the Amiens prison raid, there was no room for any error.
This was how Mosquito pilot Maxwell Sparks recalled the briefing a few months after the raid.
They brought with them a large wooden box. The lid was removed and we craned forward to see what the box contained. It was a model. A model of a building, and it looked to me at once like a prison because of the high wall around it. It sounded like a bit out of a dramatic novel.
Today, as Chris explains how the raid was carried out, it's hard to comprehend how difficult and dangerous that task must have seemed.
They say the motive was to free the prisoners.
Yeah.
The threat, of course, was it's 1944.
Exactly.
And D-Day is coming. They had no information. The Gestapo had closed down all of the resistance, so they had no help as to dispositions of German forces and things like that. So they really wanted to free some of these people, get them out.
Chris and Martin's plane starts its takeoff journey along the runway.
So we're about to recreate the journey those brave airmen embarked on in February 1944.
So webbing out there.
Yep.
Henley down the left-hand side, and they came from Hunston, which was over there, and joined. This was where they started the route, so
okay.
We're on their route from here on in.
The weather conditions were terrible, and the crews were not alone in hoping they wouldn't have to take to the skies in whiteout conditions that day.
There's a sudden snowstorm, and I remember feeling very happy that night and thinking, oh, that's all right, they can't fly in this. But of course they did. And then there was just this awful silence.
The final decision to carry out the raid was made just 2 hours before the target was due to be bombed.
Chris and Martin are in the air.
Operation Jericho could hardly have started less promisingly. 4 Mosquitoes lost contact with the formation and had to return to base, leaving 14 aircraft to continue.
Visual Broadsword 1.
There was strict radio silence to prevent the enemy detecting the approaching bombers, so it was vital the airmen didn't lose sight of their formations.
So we're going to go down the coast to Seaford.
Yep, go.
I'm navigating, and keeping track of our position is hard work. We're now on the same flight path as the Jericho raiders, But what sort of men were in the cockpit of that lead Mosquito?
Sheffield, South Yorkshire.
Charles Picard was born in Sheffield in 1915. You'll find no commemorative plaque on the wall here, but this is the birthplace of one of World War II's most celebrated and decorated pilots.
He joined the RAF at a pretty young age. I believe it was about 1936 he joined, maybe a little later. But so when the war started, he was already quite experienced pilot.
100 miles from Picard's birthplace, at the other end of Yorkshire, the other half of an enduring wartime partnership was born.
I think he'd lived for this moment of joining the RAF. He'd always wanted to fly, but he didn't reach the pilot's grade, and so he trained as a navigator.
7th of May, 78. Picard's father established the Mecca Leisure Empire, having started in the quarry business. Soon the family became wealthy and successful.
He was sent to school, quite a well-known public school called Framlingham. I don't think educationally he was particularly bright. In fact, I think his headmaster was quite hostile about his achievements at school.
Alan lived with his father and his stepmother, and they ran a large hotel called Terrace House Hotel.
My uncle, being the youngest of the family, there were five of them, and he was the youngest. So he was called Boy Picard. And so as the children all called him Uncle Boy. I remember, you know, things like playing hide and seek. A man of 6'4" wanting to play hide and seek with seven, eight, 9 year olds was unbelievable, because it was damn difficult for him to hide himself when you're that size. He was a real fun guy.
It was like, I suppose, a partnership. Pic was there. He was the tall, dashing, very foolhardy at times, but a bit of a lad. And Alan, steady, controlled, absolutely adored him. We'd do anything to be with Pick and be flying together. And if he got moved, then he always made sure that Alan moved too.
He used to go on so many different sorties, and we always used to get the most incredible stories about the various tricks he went on. But we used to get those a bit belated, because, of course, a lot of them were very secret missions.
We became formally engaged on my birthday, which was December the 4th. And then he came home, allowed leave, I think, Christmas leave. And all he said to me was, Bick and I have got a job to do when we get back. But of course he couldn't tell me what it was, and he never mentioned it further.
Kitty Jeffrey.
Pushed south across the channel to cross the FIR boundary at Ziddel in approximately 20 mics.
I'm about to experience flying at the same height as those airmen as they headed for the French coast.
To this looks like the height that they were flying.
110.
Thank you.
100.
Unfortunately, it's a still day. There's no waves.
Yeah.
This was the height they flew across the channel to avoid detection. Barely 30 feet above the waves. This kind of flying was difficult and dangerous. But not as dangerous as being detected by enemy radar.
Picard and Broadley knew all about the importance of radar. 2 years earlier, they had taken part in the daring Bruneval raid, dropping paratroopers near Le Havre. They captured parts of the German Würzburg radar installation, escaping with vital enemy technology and prisoners to waiting naval vessels.
After the Bruneval raid, he had a visitation from the King and Queen. They walked in, and the King said, "Excuse me, what are these black marks on the ceiling?" He said, "Oh, well, sir, we had a bit of a celebration last night after the Bruneval raid, and they blackened my feet and carried me along the ceiling, and those are my footmarks. And when they got to the end, the king said, "What are those two black blobs?" He said, "Well, I'm afraid, sir, that's my bottom." And of course, the king burst out laughing, but that's the sort of thing he would get up to.
This remarkable footage from Operation Jericho was shot by a camera inside one of the Mosquitoes. It shows just how close the aircraft were to the sea and to each other.
Having seen that film, Martin, I reckon this was about the height they flew.
Looks like it, doesn't it?
About 100 feet, going down to 30 feet, especially if you're flying in formation, all that does is make it really difficult for the wingmen. A moment of lack of concentration, and then it takes just a little bit of a degree before you're in the water.
Flying so low at 350 miles an hour, there was every chance that the raid could have gone catastrophically wrong before the aircraft had even crossed the channel. But the crews had been hand-picked for their skill in such high-speed precision attacks. They all knew the task facing them as well as the risks. But the chain of command through which Operation Jericho was ordered remains far from clear to this day. Maurice Buckmaster was the former head of the French section of the Special Operations Executive and one of Britain's most famous wartime spymasters. He was pressed on the subject of the raid in a Panorama interview in 1982.
Well, it's always been a bit of a mystery to me, but we were, so to speak, the lucky side beneficiaries of an attack which was organised and thought of by someone else, and I don't know who.
So his organisation didn't order the raid. So what about the SIS or MI6?
There is a letter which actually says, "I have been asked by C to express his gratitude and the gratitude of his officers for the attack carried out on Amiens prison." So C is the head of MI6?
Is he?
You know that.
I believe it's true, yeah.
So doesn't that letter at least suggest that
yes.
MI6 was involved?
I've never seen this letter or heard of it before, but did you mention it just now? That could well be, yes. I just don't know. I mean, it's not my kind of work at all.
But the SIS did not mount this particular operation at your instigation?
Not at my own, oh, no, not at all. I don't know who mounted it, I'm afraid.
The letter that Buckmaster knew nothing about is here in the National Archive. It is written on behalf of C, head of MI6, and his officers thanking the RAF for carrying out the raid, and included is what is said to be a message of thanks from the resistance. It says, "Thanks to admirable precision of the attack, the first bomb blew in nearly all the doors and 150 prisoners escaped. Of these, 12 were to have been shot on the 19th of February.
Those who are sceptical about the official version claim that this is all made up.
Ducellier. Also in this document, they point out that 50 German soldiers were killed, which is completely false. After more in-depth research, we concluded that only 5 or 6 were killed on February the 18th.
So was MI6 involved in this raid? The head of the RAF's Air Historical Branch believes it's likely.
If the suggestion, as it is believed it did, comes from resistance circles, it's got to come back either through MI6 or the SOE. It can't come back through any other organisation. One of those has got to have fed it into the RAF and asked them to do it. We know that C, the head of MI6, thanks the RAF for mounting the raid. Ergo, it seems to me pretty clear that the request came back from the resistance via MI6 to the RAF. That's not a mystery.
But according to Monsieur Ducellier, any involvement from MI6 wasn't quite so straightforward.
So in reality, there were two versions. The first aimed at the French to free the resistance and the second at the Germans, to make them believe there was a British agent in the prison who knew the secrets of the D-Day landings.
Seagulls on the sea will leap airborne at the sight of a plane. that they could come up and hit them, but the Mosquito was fairly sturdy, even for a full-speed aeroplane.
Back over the channel, the Mosquitoes didn't have their speed alone to shield them from attack.
Above each group of six Mosquitoes was a squadron of Typhoon fighters to protect them against enemy aircraft.
And Frank Wheeler was flying his first sortie for the RAF that day as a Typhoon pilot. He's the last surviving member of the fighter crews who escorted the bombers to the target.
We fell in each side of them to escort them, just a little bit above them, lining up on each side of their formation. Our job was simply to ensure that no German aircraft came in to interfere and attack them. We went across at this very low height, and when we got to the coast, to much of my amazement, they stayed at that height. We went at treetop height all the way.
Paris can't see us even now, even on the transponder, down at 100 feet.
Radar wasn't as sophisticated then as it is now, anyway.
No, and it was definitely something that we were a lot more advanced than the Germans were.
Entering French airspace, we're now less than 100 miles from the target.
And now is the point that they're effectively declaring to the world, right, we're coming.
Here we are, yeah.
But we're not going to see where we're going.
At the speed the Mosquitoes were travelling, they were a quarter of an hour from the jail, and the unsuspecting German soldiers were settling down for lunch in the guardhouse, as they always did at noon each day. Maxwell Sparks flew in the first wave of bombers to attack the jail.
We turned right and headed for Albert, turned right again and picked up the main road from Albert to Amiens, a long straight road. The beginning of it was lined with poplars, and I had to keep my wing tilted away from the poplars. We were so low. When the poplars petered out about 2 miles from that prison, a Typhoon fighter suddenly swept across in front of us. I won't say what I said, but we carried on and got tighter and tighter into formation. My wing was just in front of the leader's tailplane.
Just moments away now, and very few inside the jail would have known what was about to hit them. It's believed some prisoners had received word of the attack from resistance operatives on the outside.
Two from one, 30 seconds to overfly.
Lower and lower and lower, and down to a speed that was no more than a few knots above stalling speed with a heavy bomb load. One of the other pilots that was watching us going in saw swirls of snow from our slipstream.
The attack plan formed the template for modern air combat and is still in use today. The Mosquitoes crisscrossed the target in waves to confuse the enemy about the direction of attack. The 500-pound bombs were dropped so low, delayed fuses had to be used to stop the aircraft being destroyed by their own explosions. By the time the first wave of bombers had attacked, the Luftwaffe was alerted to the raid. German pilots were scrambled from a nearby airfield into their fighter planes. Moments later, they were airborne, hunting down Picard and his men.
Footage of German fighters.
And we're about to get our first view of the Mosquitoes' target that day. We're approaching the jail.
Overhead. You can see it's a big old building, isn't it? Even with modern-day skyscrapers.
Absolutely.
4 stories high.
Yeah.
Big wall. That's a monstrous target. I love that sort of target.
We opened the bomb doors, and around about between 10 and 15 feet, well below the wall, I saw the wing commander's wing bomb drop. I pressed my bomb tit. The aircraft lifted up, full throttle. And as we swept over the wall, I looked along the wing and up at the cupola on top of the prison, straight into the eyes of an open-mouthed guard. And there was stick hard forward, back onto the deck, and snaking away because he had a machine gun and he could have fired at us.
As Frank Wheeler circled the prison from above, he saw what the air crews had hoped to achieve.
And there was this one man, large man, getting away from the prison and clambering over the rubble to get out. Probably the first person to escape.
So, mission accomplished. Picard gave the call, red, 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 the oranges are ripe, the code for the success of the operation, an immediate return to base. They were to be the last words his men ever heard him say.
I don't know whether he stayed too long, but as it so happened, he was attacked by two fox wolves and he had no chance of escaping their deadly fire. They shot his tail off and he crashed, killed instantly.
Picard's aircraft came down in this field in Saint-Gratien, about 7 miles from Amiens. The remains of the flaming fuselage, with Picard and Broadley inside, landed by the corner of these woods. French villagers arrived first at the scene and recovered their badly burned bodies. They removed anything that would help the Germans identify the fallen airmen. The propaganda value of two such high-profile war heroes would have been huge, as would the blow to morale back in Britain. The bodies were then taken to the village hall.
It was a terrific shock.
Yeah.
Really. To have lost your group captain like that, it was terrible. After all he'd done throughout his career, Group Captain Picard and Bill Broadley, they really were heroes.
The Mosquito of squadron leader Ian McRitchie was also shot down. He survived the crash with serious injuries, but his navigator, Flight Lieutenant Dick Sampson, was killed. It's believed Picard and Broadley may have gone to look for survivors when they too were attacked.
Of course, the greatest tragedy was that they'd lost their leader, and then their famous leader and navigator. He was a hero. He was a tremendous flyer and a tremendous pilot and a great leader. And he was a great loss to the Air Force when he went. And so was the navigator.
Chris and Martin's craft.
So we've retraced the route the Mosquitoes took in 1944. And now we're a few minutes away from landing in France.
A small town with red-roofed buildings.
I'm hoping I can shed more light on how the raid came about. This part of northern France holds many unsolved wartime mysteries, some dating back to an even earlier conflict.
Toes clear, Martin.
Yep, toes clear.
We're landing at the small provincial airport at Glissy, just outside Amiens. There was a German Luftwaffe base here during the war.
The plane touches down smoothly.
You're back in front of the door.
Back on the ground, the next part of my journey will take me into the city of Amiens to find out more about Operation Jericho. But the danger wasn't yet over for the Jericho airmen as they headed for home without their leader. Maxwell Sparks and his navigator Arthur Dunlop were about to cross the coast.
He was still firing. As I turned to cross over the coast, he put a burst straight through my wing. It made a hole about that size. Yeah, right in front of the roundel. The wing dropped alarmingly. I yelled to Alan to help me with the stick, and we literally fell over the coast down onto the water. Well, we had to snake away because they have a nasty habit of firing at the water after you, you know, in the hope that the spray from the bullets will go upwards and ingest into the engine.
But Maxwell retained control of his damaged aircraft and crossed the channel to land safely. Meanwhile, Frank Wheeler managed to evade enemy attack and guided his Typhoon across the channel, despite being dangerously low on fuel. The success of the raid in military terms is beyond dispute. The accuracy, skill, and bravery of those who carried it out were beyond belief. But the damage and death was on a terrible scale. Of 700 prisoners inside, around 100 were killed. And of those who escaped, only a few dozen avoided recapture.
Martin is driving through the French countryside.
I
was such an amazing experience, that flight, navigating low level all the way across the channel, actually managing to find the prison. And here we are on that road that the mosquitoes used for their run in, this wonderful straight Roman road, which I'm using now to drive to the prison, which is going to be coming up quite soon. The jail at Amiens still houses inmates and has been largely rebuilt, but the wall still remains.
The very high brick wall.
Driving past the front of the jail, you can still see where the breach in the wall has been repaired. Maxwell Sparks reckons this is where his bomb hit. The scar in the brickwork is a permanent reminder of Operation Jericho. Outside the prison, there's a memorial to all those who died. On the anniversary of the raid, they're still remembered by the people of Amiens, as they have been every year since the attack 67 years ago. Anyone who was there will never be able to forget that day. Their memories could hold clues to the mysteries of Jericho, and every year there are fewer people who remember it.
Madame Fallou? Ah, bonjour, ici Martin. Merci.
De la prison, et puis après, ils jetaient les bombes et tout.
This is Thérèse Fellot. She was a young married woman living next to Amiens jail in February 1944. She was alone at home and 3 weeks away from giving birth when the attack came.
Madame Fellot, I hope it's not too painful for you. Could you tell us your memories of the raid and that day?
I was outside in my yard. I went to get some water when all of a sudden I heard sirens. And the airplanes appeared immediately. They almost shaved the top of the house, and then the bombs came. I ran downstairs to my cellar. I was really scared. Then I heard someone coming into the house. I went up the cellar stairs and saw this man, all covered in black. He said to me, "Some water, please, quick." I was amazed that he was still alive. I didn't even get to ask him his name. Then he ran off. So then I went outside. I had to cut through the fields because the Germans had blocked everything off. And that's when I saw all the wounded people coming out of the prison. It was horrible, horrible.
How do you feel about the raid now?
I can't forget it. It's impossible. It's too hard. I wondered who could have been bombing us. I didn't know it was the English. We were used to being bombed by the Germans, but not by the English. I've always wondered why it happened. We were told afterwards that it was to liberate two people, two resistance workers. They must have been very important to have killed so many for just the two.
Quai Bellu, Amiens. Pretty houses and shops line the waterfront.
Sitting by the River Somme, made infamous by a previous conflict, I wonder what the truth behind Operation Jericho really is. It's claimed it was to free resistance fighters. But could there be another explanation? Its position, just 75 miles from Calais, may hold some clue as to why the prison here at Amiens was bombed.
Black and white footage of warships exchanging fire, then soldiers on board landing craft.
The D-Day landings took place in June 1944, 4 months after Operation Jericho. Some believe it was to fool the Germans into thinking that the impending Allied invasion would be in this part of France, rather than along the Normandy coast. Operation Fortitude was a deception plan thought up by Allied intelligence, in the hope that the Germans would mass their forces in the Pas-de-Calais rather than Normandy. The lives of thousands of Allied troops depended on it. Monsieur Ducellier believes that Operation Jericho was one part of that plan.
The bombing of Amiens prison was the first phase of Operation Fortitude. It was his first objective. I'm sure that the real reason for the bombing was to make the Germans believe that the invasion was having to be postponed. And secondly, the location of Amiens between the Pas-de-Calais and the Somme was significant in making them believe the invasion would take place in this area.
A single raid does not per se persuade the German High Command that the Pas-de-Calais is an important area. It chimes with Operation Fortitude to a degree, so it's helpful, but it's not the reason for mounting the raid, at least in my opinion.
Sebastian Cox, head of RAF Air Historical Branch.
70 years ago, these streets were filled with fear, treachery, and secret defiance. Those who opposed the German occupation lived in constant fear of betrayal.
It's extraordinary in a place like this that is just what you would expect of a fairly quiet town. Very normal, very ordinary. And these little flats, little apartments around here, they would have been members of the resistance. The people who are remembered here, who were carrying on their underground fight with great courage, but in constant fear of that knock on the door, the Nazis and the jackboots and the machine guns and coming to execute them, or worse, their families. It's an extraordinary feeling to be in the middle of all of this.
But who were the resistance fighters inside Amiens jail, whose freedom justified risking so many lives? Were there any? The RAF's own intelligence documents include one possible name: Raymond Vivon, who had escaped the jail and the bombing. But Monsieur Ducellier believes this isn't possible.
Il y avait encore, j'ai oublié qu'on a cité beaucoup, c'est le préfet Vivant, le sous-préfet Vivant d'Abbeville.
There was an important resistance worker called Vivon. He was vice prefect of Abbeville and is often mentioned as the person who must have known something. He was imprisoned in Amiens jail on February 14th. But the operation had already been ordered several days before this, so it couldn't possibly have been mounted for him. So we have been trying to find out what members of the resistance were due to die. In 1944, everyone in the region was wondering who were these people who had to be freed. Of course, there was no end of people who were willing to say it was them, but no one has ever been found who could have been a serious contender.
For security reasons, it has not been possible until now to give a full account of this exploit.
This is how the story of the raid was finally presented to the British public 8 months after it was carried out.
Led by Group Captain Picard of Target for Tonight fame, it was to prove his last flight.
But back at the National Archives, documents showed that just weeks before, there was official concern and confusion about just how to tell the story of Operation Jericho. In this note from the then Air Commodore David Atcherley, he struggles to disguise his frustration at the draft press release he'd been sent to consider.
Obviously DPR, that's the Department of Public Relations, obviously DPR intends the story to be splashed across the British newspapers. We know that the French are a bit out of sympathy with the purpose of the operation, and it is reasonable to assume that if uninformed and misleading criticisms, verbally or press, from France are to be anticipated, we shall have to make certain of the intelligence facts. And he puts the word facts in inverted commas.
But despite the absence of facts, the RAF PR machine was still desperate to get the story out.
Why were so many high-ranking RAF officers involved in ensuring that the right version of the story came out?
In the words of the briefing officer, mosquitoes are to attack the prison at Amiens to assist more than 100 prisoners to escape. These prisoners are French patriots condemned to death for assisting the Allies.
In France, or should I say in Amiens, certain voices began to be raised saying, why have we never found these members of the resistance? They looked and never found anyone, even the resistance themselves.
So, despite the RAF claiming the raid was to free resistance fighters, no one was ever identified. 10 years later, the French began asking once again, why was the prison bombed?
Rue Jean Bouin, Amiens.
But then a new story emerged from an unlikely place. Jean-Claude Belloy was a French soldier sent to Cyprus at the height of the Suez Crisis in 1956. But whilst there, did he unwittingly become part of a new deception plan by British intelligence?
One day, a colleague in the regiment told me that an Englishman wanted to meet me because I was from Amiens. A car came to pick me up. It was a senior British officer, and he told me his story. He said he was parachuted twice into the Amiens area, but the second time he was wounded, captured, and he had his leg amputated, then was thrown into Amiens prison. His story absolutely amazed me, especially when he told me why it was so important for him to escape. He said he was an important link in a chain of events, leading to the Normandy landings a few months later. It was very important for him to meet someone who came from the place where he'd been imprisoned. I now think it was in the hope that I would tell people what he had told me.
And when he returned with that revelation, he found a city willing to accept a new version of why its prison was bombed.
Actually, the whole deception worked a treat, because when Jean-Claude Belloy returned home from military service, he told the story to the people of Amiens and to the newspapers. And so the story went on for 60 years. Well, I say hats off to the British Secret Service, because I'm really impressed by their techniques.
I think the idea of there being some super ace secret agent in Amiens prison that is the man that they're really seeking to release is something maybe for the novel than the history book.
Martin is in a graveyard.
We all inwardly felt that he'd been killed, because he'd been on loads of secret missions before, and for us all to be summoned in the way we were, we thought there's something very serious here.
I decided there and then that I would presume he would be safe, and I wouldn't let any other idea come into my head.
Kitty, Alan's fiancé.
Here it is. The last resting place of Group Captain Picard. Age 28. And just behind him there is his navigator flight lieutenant Broadley, 23.
Picard and Broadley were buried by the French, but it would be months before loved ones back home would have their worst fears confirmed.
George Broadley, Alan's brother.
He was posted missing for so long. Well, I'm certain the whole family knew that he must have been killed.
There was still no news, and I knew he'd bought my engagement ring, and so I wrote to the group captain and said that I'd be glad if he would send the ring to me, and I would like to have it and wear it.
There was always the hope that he was in a prisoner of war camp, That sort of news filters back.
I came down one morning and the paper was on the table and I just picked it up and read it. And there was this big headline. I had no warning, no inkling that it would be in the papers like that with big headlines. And I just broke down immediately.
Great, great sadness, particularly my grandmother, who was absolutely devoted to him. She broke down, as did my mother and my aunt. We as children were sort of just sat there dumbfounded by it all.
It was as though, you know, all your hopes were dashed. You kept hoping it wasn't true, but of course it was.
Both men were only too aware that they had lived a charmed life, and that their next sortie could be their last. This letter from Picard was only to be delivered should he fail to return from a raid. It's written to Lord Londonderry, the godfather to his son Nicholas. He left instructions as to his education and future. Picard wrote in the letter, "For nearly 2 years now, I've had the feeling that one day or night I shall be knocked down, and although myself I am not afraid, I do feel my responsibilities."
a photograph of Picard's baby son.
My chances of being taken alive are remote, as I always carry a revolver and intend fighting it out. If you hear I am a prisoner, it will be because either I'm too badly injured to fight, or because I funked it. The French made their own cross when Picard was first buried. On it they wrongly engraved the Victoria Cross, an honour never awarded to him.
The Ministry of Defence asked the French to remove the VC, and so the then French ambassador went to see the Minister of Defence and said, look, you know, he did wonderful things for the French, not just the Amiens raid, but many others, and so, you know, we feel he should get the VC. Why have you not given him the VC? They would give no reason. He did over 100 sorties. He should get the VC for that alone. We have launched campaigns from time to time, but of course it's so long ago now that it seems to me that the Ministry of Defence don't really want to know anymore.
It seems extraordinary that so few people now know the name of Charles Picard and of the operation which he led.
I think he'd wanted to become an actor at the end of the war, but he'd have had the opportunities because his sister Helena was married to Sir Cedric Hardwicke, who was a very prominent actor at the time. So he had all the right contacts if he wanted to get into the business.
Operation Jericho was an extraordinary raid. Of that there is no doubt. But why it took place, and so many lost their lives, remains a mystery.
Look, Martin, I'd like to stress this. There's no way that I was a hero in this job. My part was minuscule. It was over and done in 5 seconds. The real heroes, I think, of this particular raid were the French resistance fighters who were incarcerated in the prison.
I'm not sure if we will ever get completely to the bottom of this story. Let's not pretend that we've got the full story when we haven't, and let's not fill up the gaps with possibles, make-believes, who knows. And maybe one day there will be that document, one day there will be that diary, one day there will be that photograph, and then we'll have a good story. And a full story.
Mark Seaman, intelligence historian. An aerial view of a cemetery with neat rows of identical markers.
They say that truth is often the first casualty of war. We may never know the real reason why those French patriots died in the rubble of Amiens jail. But the men who led the raid that cut short those lives are buried just yards from here. And make no mistake, all those brave airmen truly believed that they were giving the resistance a choice, albeit a stark one. Death or freedom.
Words engraved in stone read, "Their name liveth forevermore."